Hello once more, welcome to a very special Minefield today. We are, of course, part of Radio National, and one thing that Radio National is doing this week in the lead-up to the International Day of People with Disability, which happens on Saturday, is what we're calling a one-in-five campaign. This reflects the fact that almost 20% of Australians live with a disability, and it is in that context that we gather, that we convene for another edition of the Minefield today and try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas that modern life seems to throw at us incessantly. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my erstwhile co-host.
Indeed. It seems strange, though. We want to put a bit of a Minefield slant, I think, on this particular topic. And I think one of the things that's a real danger whenever we gather around the topic of disability is that it becomes one of those marginal or fringe concerns. In other words, we devote a particular week to it so that we don't have to talk about it the rest of the time. But what I want to suggest to you, Waleed, is that the precise moral issues surrounding the way that we talk about and think about disability, I think go right to the heart of the human condition. And it ought to reframe, I think, the way we think about just about everything instead of just this one topic. So let me show how that might be. Earlier this year, the French Broadcasting Council banned a brief video from being shown on French television. And I know what you're thinking. It was probably gratuitous sex or, you know, overly violent content. No, all that it was a brief video depicting a number of young people with Down syndrome from around the world, talking in different languages, attempting to allay the fears that many women have about raising a child with Down syndrome. Now, that fear, it seems to me, is quite pervasive. Just reckon with the fact that over 90% of Down syndrome pregnancies in the US and Europe alone end in abortion. This video, which I found immensely moving, is called Dear Future Mom. Now, it's not disingenuous or sentimental. It doesn't sugarcoat the challenges surrounding parenthood generally, much less raising a child with a disability. What the video does is it portrays young people with Down syndrome simply as fully human, as capable of happiness and ambition and adventure, and it portrays them as proper objects, not of fear, but of parental love, pride, and delight.
Dear future mom,
tuo figlio potrà essere felice
come la sono io,
e tu seras heureuse aussi.
It's just a small sample of this video, which I would encourage you to search for on your favorite search engines, called Dear Future Mom. Now, earlier this month, France's Conseil d'État, or Council of State, upheld the ban. It said that by portraying these young people as happy, that it was fundamentally inappropriate because, quote, that this video was likely to disturb the conscience of women who had lawfully made different personal life choices. In other words, they had decided to terminate Down syndrome pregnancies. Now, for me, Waleed, I'm not sure about you, but this points to a really troubling aspect of the way we think about disability. We in the West, we extend those with a disability a certain dignity and support, say physical access or insurance schemes like the NDIS. But it seems to me that lurking in the background is a deeper wish that such people didn't exist in the first place. In other words, it seems that our liberal humanism can't help but withhold from them full humanity. Just think about the whole array of tests, of prenatal tests, of genetic counseling that are available within the hospital system to ensure that children with a disability aren't even born. Think of the panic and the fear surrounding the Zika virus at the moment. It seems to me, Waleed, that this is pointing to one of the uglier social impulses that our so-called moral progress has nowhere near left behind. We seem to have a certain intolerance of disability and dependency that smells to me an awful lot like the eugenics that were so much part of certain forms of fascism and totalitarianism in the first part of the 20th century. In other words, Waleed, it seems to me that when we talk about the way we think about disability, about what we owe one another, and about what it means to be human, by discussing this topic, we couldn't get more morally fundamental than this. What do you think?
You sound like a highfalutin version of Stella Young, a little bit, actually, Scott.
Oh, high praise indeed.
I agree with the point. I agree with the principle you're trying to evoke here. The example, it confuses me, though, I'll confess. So if it wasn't about Down syndrome children, if it was just about children generally, you would find the same backlash, right? Because what this is really about is cutting across two different groups of people who could argue that they'd been marginalised and had their agency taken away from them. In the one case, those with a disability. In the other case, women. And particularly given the long and unending fight that activists are having in order to preserve women's rights to choose, particularly when it comes to abortion. I think what there is a tendency for everything that enters into that sphere to be framed within that, right, as a matter of choice. And I do think there is a really interesting, much richer conversation to be had about what exactly the nature of choice is, where does choice come from, to what extent is it unbounded, all of those sorts of things, which might inform any kind of abortion debate that we're not in the process of having, so I won't bother going into it. But there is something nonetheless within that broad framework of interrogating the notion of choice that does apply here. And that is what a campaign like that is trying to do, or indeed what one or other disability theorist over time has been trying to do, is to interrogate whether or not the choices that we make, the impressions that we have, the criteria that we use to evaluate the worth of certain lives, is something that we recognise as being as partial as it is. Mm. So the argument goes that if the world was built to suit people who were short-statured, so that ceilings were small and were low to the ground and so on and so forth, and everything was to scale, then suddenly it would be those who were not short-statured that would have the disability. That is, there is a kind of relativism to these things. And by reinforcing a perspective on the world that privileges those who do not have a disability, and I use the term disability as Stella would have wanted me to, then I think if we're not aware of those things, or we're not confronting those things, then it becomes very easy for us to make unthinking choices that are fundamentally degrading of the humanity of people, and particularly of disabled people. And so the point that you're making, I think ultimately I arrive at that conclusion. I'm just not sure I would do it through this particular example.
Yeah, look, I like what you're doing there. And I agree, this is not a conversation about abortion. And I think any attempt to conflate the conversation with a conversation about abortion is fundamentally mistaken.
But the point I'm making is I think that is the conversation that the Conseil d'État were having.
Yes, and I think it was an attempt to try to preserve and protect the consciences of women from being otherwise, if you like, traumatized in the wake of the decision that they've made. And I wouldn't want to say for a moment that the decision that was being made was somehow taken lightly. The sheer weight of the fears and concerns that many women have concerning the prospect of giving birth to a child with a disability and raising that child are profound. And I think one of the things that this particular video did beautifully is it tried to, if you like, envelop the concern with disability within a larger narrative. It tried to swallow it up within something else. It tried to take, if you like, some of the sting out of needless or unnecessary fear. What I would want to suggest to you, though, Waleed, is that I think that the problem concerning choice, what informs choice, what surrounds choice, what predates choice, or what
the conditions of choice.
The conditions of choice, I actually think that even goes more radical than you're letting on. It's not simply that choice, a free choice, can only be made when accurate knowledge is in place or when certain unnecessary fears have been put to rest. I think the question is choice as such fundamental, or is there something that is metaphysically, that is ethically prior to choice, that relativizes choice itself? So I'd say, for instance, that one of the things that we see increasingly in the way we talk about choice generally is there's a desire not to be burdened by things that we don't choose. I mean, this is, I think, in some respects, a kind of social immunity. We don't want to be burdened by our elderly, for instance. We don't want to be burdened by a high need or high care child. We only feel bound by those things insofar as we choose them. Whereas it seems to me that fundamental to any serious ethical concern is that there are certain things that you simply cannot choose. There are things you can renounce, but the choice to some extent is already made for you. We are already bound up in networks of acknowledged dependency. And it's that acknowledged dependency that is what makes us human, and the refusal to acknowledge that dependency, that we ourselves will go through various stages of dependence, of deep need from other people, that we ourselves are caught in relationships of giving and receiving, of being burdened and in turn being burdens, I think that's, if you like, the fundamental moral background that often gets airbrushed out whenever we simply make this about choice and only wanting to have those binding relationships insofar as I choose them and keep on choosing them. That, for me, Waleed, is absolutely fundamental.
And what I would add to that is this, what I regard as a dangerous notion of perfectibility. And so the minute we begin to try to engage with that as the goal, with some kind of desire to perfect everything that either surrounds us or emanates from us, then we enter into very, very dangerous territory.
Absolutely.
That has underwritten pretty much every fascist or totalitarian or just fascistic approach to politics that we've seen in the 20th century. But I digress.
Hang on, though. In this particular case, though, that desire for perfectibility isn't simply utopian or much less Aryan or supremacist. In our case, it seems to me that that desire for perfectibility is, if you like, a perfection of fluid, non-binding relationships. We want relationships only insofar as we choose them. If we don't choose them, we shouldn't be bound by them.
The desire to lead the perfectly efficient life.
Thank you.
Which I think is a bit scary. This is The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website, by the way. Search for RN The Minefield, or you can tweet us at RN The Minefield. We are here today as part of Radio National's One in Five campaign. This is in the lead up to the International Day of People with Disability, which is occurring on Saturday. One in five, of course, reflecting roughly the ratio of Australians who do live with a disability.
I'm thrilled to show up for this show every week. It's not that often, though, that I feel myself positively beside myself with excitement about the guests that we have on the show. This, however, is one of those weeks. Rosemary Garland Thompson is professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. She's one of the pioneers of disability studies and the author of, to my mind, two of the finest books written in the second half of the 20th century, Extraordinary Bodies and Staring, How We Look. And it's our great pleasure to welcome her. She's joining us by Skype today. Hi, Rosemary.
Hello. Thank you very much. It's really a delight to be with you.
Let me try to put, this is a difficult question, I think, but I couldn't think of any other way of framing, I suppose, the particular concern we want to get to. So often we tend to think about disability as a problem that needs to be overcome or a problem that needs to be ameliorated. That solution might be benign, so greater access or an insurance scheme. That solution might be brutal. So, for instance, termination of pregnancies and so forth. I wanted to ask you, is disability a problem to be overcome, or does it itself point to something, if you like, more fundamental about the human condition?
Disability, and I think this is important for us in liberal democracies and liberal societies to embrace, and that is that disability is a fundamental part of the human condition. These human variations that we think of as disabilities, that we name disabilities, are a part of every life and a part of every family. And so in, again, liberal modern societies that are committed to egalitarian social organization and rule of law and equality, we are best off to understand disability is as part of what it means to be human, and to understand the constituted group of people with disabilities to be very broad and capacious and to have very porous borders, because the truth of it is that all of us will move in and out of this category of disability, this social category, over a lifetime. So disability is not a matter of those of us who are in the category and those of us who aren't, those of us who have disabilities and those of us who are non-disabled, but rather it is a fluid social identity and way of being in the world that we need to address and be aware of in all of our interactions with one another, all of our political and social decision and policy making.
But Rosemary, is that enough when there are certain categories of disability that are not fluid? And that they're the ones that tend to prick our conscience, or perhaps fail to prick our conscience when they should.
Well, in fact, I would want to hold on to the idea that all categories of disability are fluid in some way. I mean, we have a kind of hierarchy of disability that is provided for us through a medical understanding of disability. We have a hierarchy or an arrangement or a set of definitions about what counts as disability that is provided for us by political and legal definitions. But the most important thing, I think, is to understand that because we are, and this is very philosophical, I love to say this, we are enfleshed as beings. In other words, we are made of flesh and bone and blood. And the interaction of our being as we move through a world will produce the human variations, the human ways of being that we think of as disability throughout this journey, if you will, that we call life. And so if we can come to understand disability and being disabled in this way, I think it will help us to achieve the promise of liberal democracies and liberal societies, and that is of equal opportunity and equal respect for all persons, this inheritance from human rights and egalitarian thinking that came to us more or less in the 18th century. So if we try to demedicalize, if you will, disability and to imagine it as a fluid identity that has a history, that now, of course, has a vibrant political and legal identity, I think it will help us to move through these kinds of conflicts that you described in the first introduction here to the program.
But it seems to me, though, Rosemary, that what you're describing really would go against the entire flow, the entire grain of so much Western culture. So, for instance, disability itself is measured against certain concepts that are more, or certain categories, if you like, that are more appropriate to what it would be regarded as being fully able-bodied. For instance, the idea that we still associate the notion of dignity with full autonomy, with not being radically dependent upon other people, whereas bringing dignity far back closer, if you like, to notions of dependence, of mutual giving and receiving, that would be overturning or redefining a notion that is so much at the heart of so many moral debates at the moment that it couldn't help, it seems to me, but be quite a radical step.
That's true. And if we look at the history of the development of liberal societies, from ideas of egalitarian societies, ideas of equality, ideas of human rights that are part of our inheritance in liberal democracies now, we see that the development of these ideas, of course, are profoundly inflected by the power relations that have structured most of society. So when, as we know, liberal societies began to become institutionalized, and the documents that were part of creating these liberal societies based on egalitarian principles and human rights, that what counted as fully human was a very narrow definition of a person. For one thing, it was primarily a male person. So if we look at the history of expanding the notion of what counts as human, expanding the notion of what counts as a rights-bearing individual, we have a really clear, I think, trajectory beginning more or less in the 18th century, or you can, of course, even go before that in the development of what we might call liberal societies. And you can see how the struggle has been politicized, it has been legalized, the struggle to increase the range of what counts as a person who is accorded full rights, full dignity, and full access to the privileges and obligations of citizenship. And I think that's a very good story. And it has also produced a number of conflicts. And the main conflict, I think, that you've focused on that is really important is the conflict between the right to self-determination and reproductive liberty for women, but certainly for all people. In other words, the right to self-determination, the right to create the family and the life that one wants, that's a very important right in liberal societies. That is in direct conflict with the right to life of people with disabilities and the right to access to the privileges and obligations of citizenship. And that's being played out in various policy making initiatives and in the development of technology and certainly in the free market around the right to abortion and the right to life, as we call that.
But once we take once we attach human dignity and the meaning of being fully human to some kind of access to civic life form of criterion, isn't this what naturally follows? Because there are certain kinds of disabilities that are profound enough, such as to deny people access to civic life. For example, they will not be in a position, they may not have the capacity to vote, for example. Children might become excluded from that. And that is a parallel, and you find a parallel in history with the way that people who were not considered fully human were denied the right to vote, and then they kind of had to fight for those sort of things. I actually retain some of Scott's concerns here, that in the process of trying to expand the category of what is human along liberal / civic / individual / rights-bearing lines, then the more we are in danger of hollowing out anything richer that connotes humanity, anything that is more inalienable than someone who is a mere bearer of rights, which then, of course, raises the question of what the source of those rights might be and then how it is we can go about potentially stripping people of them.
I think the important thing to think about in this respect is how we imagine citizens and individuals going about participating in civic life. For example, we might look now at people with significant cognitive or developmental disabilities, and we might say now, how could these people possibly participate in civic life? How could they vote? How could they use the transportation system? And I think what we need to do is to look back historically and to realize that the expansion of what counts as human, the expansion of what counts as a rights-bearing citizen with the with access to participating fully in the civic order has changed dramatically. As we know, before, let's say, 1920 in the United States, the argument went that women could not exercise the rights and obligations of full citizenship because they were understood as physiologically and developmentally inferior enough that they could not participate fully as citizens. And so that, of course, seems incomprehensible to us now, because we have expanded quite successfully, in my view, access to civic obligations and privileges in ways that we never imagined we could be able to do before. So I think what we want to try to do is to think about how to create a society that allows all people some kind of access to civic participation, and of course, access to economic equality, access to the distribution of resources and protections under the law, which is what the disability laws are about. Let's start with the example of Down syndrome that you mentioned. Down syndrome has been defined medically in terms of medical conditions, in terms of limitations, in terms of pathology. But we understand now that the treatment for Down syndrome, say, at least in the United States, up until quite recently, was to immediately institutionalize children with Down syndrome, to take them out of a family and to put them into some sort of care facility. And of course, no one thrives in those circumstances. So it became a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that people with Down syndrome had developmental disabilities that would disqualify them from many of the activities of full citizenship and relationships in society. But now, ironically, when 90% of people with Down syndrome are not brought into the world, really across the world, but certainly in liberal societies, it is at the same time the very best time for a person with Down syndrome to be able to thrive and to flourish in our societies because of the laws, because of the increased access, because of the access to education and to better health care than people have ever had before in general. So there's a real irony here that it's a great time to be a person with a disability in most liberal societies in the United States, certainly in Australia, in terms of being able to flourish and being able to have access to the same kinds of activities that non-disabled people have access to. But it's also a very threatening time, eugenically, if you will, in terms of the sculpting of the human communities that is taking place through a variety of different sets of testing and reproductive technologies that are combined with the idea of reproductive liberty.
Rosemary, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been great to get your expertise.
Thank you.
That's Rosemary Gallen-Thompson, a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta in Georgia. Scott?
Jump on our website and leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. You can follow us on Twitter, of course. Just look for R in the Minefield. If you haven't already, well, you know, what's your excuse? You really should subscribe to the podcast as well, because you'll find invariably some extra content that you would never have seen coming. So why not jump on our podcast and listen for more? Rosemary, you raised the example of gender struggle, and I do recognize that you come to disability studies from within or tied to your commitment to feminism and your work on feminism. But I wonder if there isn't, in fact, a deeper connection here with, for instance, the civil rights movement. There's something visceral, if you like, about our attachment to our individual freedom from obligations to others that in many respects parallels or echoes the visceral repulsion that many people felt in the 40s and 50s in particular towards non-segregation.
This is exactly right. And I'm very glad that you brought up the idea of, I love the term acknowledged dependency. And of course, this is part of the mixed history of what we call individualism. So on the one hand, individualism has given us a society that imagines right-bearing citizens who go through the world enacting these rights to self-determination. And what that has erased, of course, is our obligations to one another. So the idea of individual choices, of the right to self-determination by an individual, comes in conflict very often with what is between what is good for the individual and what is good for the community. And one really interesting example of this that I like to bring up very often is the development of the technologies that make it possible to determine sex and to perform sex selection abortion. And this has created, through the idea of the right to self-determination and reproductive liberty, some crucial social problems throughout the world in places where sex selection abortion is practiced quite assiduously. And of course, what that has done is to create an imbalance between the number of men born, boys born into the world, and the number of girls born into the world. And this has created tremendous social problems that basically have created an epidemic of violence. Violence often against women. And it has to do with the social reality that disenfranchised men, when they don't have access to women, often are the most violent members of our society. So when certain groups of men are disenfranchised, in other words, by not being able to have access to women because they are in a lower social status than other men, when there is not an equal distribution of men and women in a society, when that is broken apart by the technology of this reproductive liberty to put together the family that you want in terms of whether you want boys or girls in your family, it produces communal problems that are unintended consequences. And it's a great example of why we need to have ethical deliberations about the development and use of technologies in general, but certainly reproductive technologies and what the unintended consequences of these technologies might be.
Well, Lee, this is fascinating to me. It seems like so many of our programs keep coming back to this issue of incommensurable rights, of different or competing rights claims. And I'm really interested what you think about this, Waleed, because I can't help but feel, I mean, I'm committed to the notion of human rights, obviously. And yet I can't help but feeling that we always enter these conversations two steps too late. There's a conversation we should be having before this about what might ground the notion of rights to begin with that then constrains what we can claim in the name of rights afterwards.
Yeah, we've discussed that before in the context of, well, all sorts of things, asylum seekers them, for example. But I don't know that it's a conversation that's prior so much as it's a conversation that has to exist in a perpetual present, right? So as long as rights has become something that has now become, you know, it's effectively been relegated to a series of partisan political claims. You either believe in certain rights, which puts you in one political position, or you don't, which puts you in another. And what is eroded from that is any kind of moral or ethical or even political consensus on what we're trying to build on top of, like what the foundations of this are. And I do think that's precisely the problem that we have with the conversation that we've had today, with every conversation that grounds these things, is that ultimately, Scott, I think you and I are arguing for at least the search for some notion of rights that isn't grounded in a liberal notion of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's grounded in something more than that. The thing that stuck with me from what you said earlier was that the idea of dignity, even our conception of dignity, is profoundly
liberal.
Yeah, that's right. Right. So if we can't even conceive of dignity as being anything that's thicker than unbounded choice and independence, however illusory those things are, if we can't even think of dignity as something that is thicker than that, how can we possibly think of rights in total as being thicker than that, when rights lend themselves so easily to this kind of liberal conception of, you know, self-realization, self-actualization, really realizing your own potential, everybody pursuing their own ends in a way that John Stuart Mill would have applauded.
Of course, we need to always remember that our liberal heritage is based not just on rights, but it's based rights and privileges. It's also based on obligations.
Absolutely.
And that's partly what these anti-discrimination and protection laws, such as the so-called disability laws that we have, or any kind of equality law, that's what they remind us of, and that is what our obligations are to one another.
And they are under renewed assault, and the defences that are articulated for them tend not to be done in liberal terms, because it feels like the language of liberalism has been colonised more or less by this idea of individual freedom. And
well, I think it's important to remember that the idea of liberalism has been very emphatically inflected by the free market economy that goes along with liberal societies. So in terms, for example, of genetic testing and prenatal testing that we began by speaking about, this is driven not through deliberations that would be democratic deliberations, but rather it is controlled by the free market. And that is one of the things that I think is our greatest challenge, is how to balance a free market economy, which is really the tool of self-determination, and our sense of the obligations that government has to its citizens.
Look, this does bring me back, though, to the issue that we kind of began this additional little podcast bit with. And that's that whereas the struggle for, if you like, control over women is very much a matter of power and retaining certain fixed power relationships, whereas the struggle for civil rights was overcoming a whole lot of very visceral concerns that weren't simply a matter, if you like, of logic or alternate social structures or political structures, but it was overcoming certain base fears. And here I think of Martha Nussbaum in particular, her remarkable work on the power of disgust and fear over our relationships with other people. And I can't help but thinking, as we talk about disability, and this is why the Dear Future Mom video really moved me deeply, because this was directed at the moral emotions. This was directed at something quite visceral. It was trying to overcome the fear that is wrapped up with the prospect of the loss of my autonomy. And that might be the autonomy that I have as an adult, that I don't need to feel overly burdened by a child, or that autonomy might be the desire or the freedom that I hold on to sort of ease out of relationships that are unnecessarily binding. So I keep coming back to this question: isn't the struggle for reforming the imagination concerning disability, this is a struggle that, if you like, that goes all the way down into the very emotional substructure of the way that we understand human being?
Well, I think at the bottom of this is a basic conflict in understanding between what we might think of as traditional subjects and modern subjects, if you will. And this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but I think it's a useful way of thinking. So one of the hallmarks of the modern subject is the concept of a rights-bearing individual who practices autonomy and self-determination to create a life. And in contrast to that is the idea of, say, the subject who is obliged to another set of responsibilities, a subject that is open to whatever is given in life. And those are really two different understandings of subjectivity. And the more traditional idea, the idea that what will come to us will come to us, rather than what will come to us is what we have chosen and structured for us. Those are two different ways of imagining our subjectivity. And I think they're in conflict a bit. And the one, of course, that is holding the most power is the one that in which we imagine ourselves being totally responsible for all the choices, everything that happens to us through the decisions that we make in the present, and that this will control our future. And this is what I think is perhaps most difficult for women exercising reproductive liberty now, because suddenly they are, rather suddenly, they are in a position to making a decision in the present that they imagine will structure their future and their future life. And I think that's what makes women very much afraid about having a child with a disability, because the stories that we tell, the attitudes that we receive about disability is that disability is a disadvantage, disability is expensive, disability is suffering, disability is stigma, disability is rejection. And this is what the disability rights movement has worked quite hard to change, and that is to make the general public understand what kinds of contributions disability itself and people with disabilities make to the world.
That's a fabulous note to leave it on.